Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Welcome to episode 18 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Monday, November 27, 2017. In the art house, you will meet a woman who uses movement to help her community visualize our rapidly changing climate. We also hear answers to the puzzler question about extreme weather. Can these be tied to climate change? But first, racers, start your engines. Today on the show, you are going to meet an unlikely climate advocate, an indie car racer. Meet Aaron Tellitz. Originally from Birchwood, Wisconsin, when he was just a kid, Aaron demonstrated his ability to move quickly. He grew up at a fishing resort and could fillet a bluegill fish in 25 seconds. Wanting to experience the thrill of more speed, Aaron turned to amateur car racing, which led to a career as an Indy race driver.
When I was growing up, I started racing go-karts, and when I got into car racing, the most simple or the most logical path was this system called the Mazda Road to Indy, and there are Mazda scholarships that you can win along the way to help drivers out in funding, because funding is a huge part of racing.
I was curious to talk to Aaron about his racing because he is a driver who is also committed to addressing climate change. I was confused. Other than an airplane, I couldn't imagine a means of transportation that used much more fuel per mile. It seemed so strange to me.
You know, obviously, it is strange that my career path is me rocketing around a racetrack in a high horsepower race car that's burning fossil fuels, but I'm also a huge advocate for renewables. Basically, I love the idea of a carbon fee. I don't want humans to leave the planet worse than we started off with it, which I think we've been seeing that happening, where in the past we didn't really know we were doing it, where now we know what we're doing and we just need to change it. To be honest, I don't think racing is the problem. To be honest with you, racing pioneers a lot of the technologies, I think, that goes into vehicles to make them more efficient. Any of the energy recovery systems that are in your Prius or anything like that, Formula One's been using it now for years and years and making it better and better. Each lap in Formula One, they regenerate something like 200 horsepower of electric energy that they then use the next lap. I think they're kind of pioneering the way for making cars more and more efficient. I don't think that racing is that detrimental. Yes, we are rocketing around burning fossil fuels, but I think that the good of the technology that goes into race cars can help. I know quite a few drivers that are think a lot like myself, and we'd like to do something about it. We don't want to be viewed as the bad guys that are just burning all the gasoline and don't care about the planet.
I admit I know very little about professional car racing and the different types of races out there. Aaron broke it down for me.
NASCAR is American-based, obviously, stock cars. IndyCar is kind of North America, so there is a IndyCar race in Canada, but mostly in the United States, IndyCar racing, and that's open wheel racing, so there's no fenders on those cars. They look kind of like rocket ships on the ground, basically. And then Formula One is a worldwide championship, so they race on virtually every continent except for Antarctica, and it's a really long season. And those cars are also open wheel cars, but slightly different than IndyCar, where each team in Formula One has to design and then build their own race cars and then compete with those cars. So each team has their own car, basically, where in IndyCar, there's one chassis manufacturer called Dallara that makes all the cars, and then there's two engine manufacturers, Chevy and Honda, that supply the engine. IndyCars and Formula One cars look similar to most people. They would think they're kind of the same cars. But there are some big differences there.
These past two seasons, Aaron has advanced quickly as a professional race driver.
This was the highest level of racing that I've been involved in. Indy Lights, that's one level below IndyCar. That would be like AAA baseball or minor league hockey or college football, whatever sport you want to compare it to. It's the level just before the big leagues, the pros. So it was tough, but I won the first race of the year. I won the last race of the year. I came in second place in our biggest race of the season at Indianapolis Speedway. So lots of highs, but quite a few lows that held me back from finishing a little higher up in the championship than I would have liked. But obviously still a great season. I would say last year was probably my biggest season of my career, winning the Pro Mazda championship last year in 2016.
I asked Aaron about his car.
The Indy Lights car is a Dallara chassis. That's an Italian race car chassis builder. It's a carbon fiber tub. The chassis of the car, where all the parts bolt onto, is all made out of carbon fiber. All the bodywork, the wings, everything is made out of carbon fiber as well. So it's a very, very light car. The engine is a Mazda 2-liter engine that's turbocharged, and it produces 450 horsepower with a 50 horsepower push-to-pass assist. So it can make up to 500 horsepower. And the entire car itself, plus the driver, weighs about 1,350 pounds. So the power-to-weight ratio is pretty good there. And we use Cooper tires, so big Cooper slick tires. So there's no tread on them when we're in dry conditions. You can create more grip with slick tires, actually. And then when it rains, we have treaded tires that would look more like what you'd see in your car. It's got a 6-speed paddle shift gearbox. We only use the clutch when we leave pit lane and get onto the racetrack. And then after that, you're just flapping gears with the paddles on the wheels.
Flapping gears with the paddles on the wheel. I'll have to use that sometime. Now, exactly how fast does this car go, and how much gasoline does it use?
The fastest speed that I went this year was 212 miles an hour at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and that's obviously an incredible speed. But Indy Lights cars, they're a race car, so the gas mileage figure is obviously going to be in the single digits. But when you think about how fast the car is going and how much horsepower it's making, to still be getting, let's say, 3 to 4 to 5 to even sometimes 6 miles to the gallon when you're going that fast, depending on what kind of track you're at and how much full throttle time there is. Honestly, that's not too bad when you think about it, because think about your car that you're only driving maybe 60 or 70 miles an hour, and let's say it gets, 25 to 40 miles to the gallon. Yeah, that sounds great, but if you tried to get that car and that engine to go 212 miles an hour, it would have to drink so much fuel to go that fast that it's not that efficient. I think race cars are extremely efficient. A lot of people don't equate efficiency with power, but they should, because the more efficiently you can burn fuel, the faster the car is going to go. So really using the fuel efficiently is something that race cars do pretty well.
When I spoke with Aaron, he had just finished his daily workout. Turns out he needs to keep himself in good physical shape for car racing, and he needs to keep his weight to a minimum. I assumed it was to keep his car as light as possible.
Well, the weight actually has more to do with the seats that we make. So in our cars, there isn't a set seat that you sit into. When you get fitted into an Indy Lights car or an Indy car or any open wheel car, you basically sit in the car with a bag full of these little foam beads or space beads in a bag. And then they add a resin that goes in, and they suck all the air out. And when the air goes out, it reacts and it forms to your body. So you have a custom made seat. And so if you lose too much weight or you gain too much weight, your seat no longer fits you, and it's very expensive to make another one of these seats. So really, at the start of the year, whatever you weigh and you make your seat, you don't want to change that body type too much throughout the rest of the season. So I weigh about 150 pounds, and I keep it right there at about 150 all year. It's hard to eat healthy, honestly, on race weekends. You're not at home, you're going out to eat a lot, and it's easy to load up on a lot of carbs, which is good for, lots for exercise the next day. But then if you keep carrying that out and eating way too many carbs, that can slowly build up if you're not working it off or having a good workout regimen. So I try to limit my carb intake. I would say that's the one thing that I stay away from. Stay away from sugars. Try not to eat a ton of bread, although I love pasta and pizza and all of that food that has tons of carbs in it. So that's a bit of my weakness.
Glad I have something in common with a race driver. Aaron decided to do something radical this year with his racing. At the beginning of the season, he chose to impose a voluntary carbon fee on his car. He learned about Citizens Climate Lobby's proposal to put a fee on carbon usage per ton. He agreed he would charge himself $15 for every ton of carbon he emitted. He was surprised how little the fee actually cost him in the end.
Citizens Climate Lobby is working on getting a carbon fee and dividend enacted. So I thought I would take that exact model and put it into basically offsetting my carbon footprint in racing this year. So we calculated how much fuel we used in all the races this year and how many sets of tires we had to use, tires made of oil, that there's going to be a carbon footprint involved in that. We added it all up and I think it was 600 gallons or so of fuel, 60 sets of tires, somewhere around there. So this is just for a race car. For an entire race car for a whole year, I think the carbon fee came out to, I think it was under $300. And we're talking about a race car that's burning tons of fossil fuels, using huge tires, and the fee still comes out to be not breaking the bank when we're talking about race cars that cost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And over the course of the season, it cost the team over $1 million to run this car. And the carbon fee that would go along with that is tiny compared to the rest of it. So I was really surprised about that. That should kind of take some of the scariness that people think when they hear a carbon fee and they hear about how much we're polluting. I don't think they understand that the fee is pretty reasonable that would be associated with it to just kind of get people to curb their habits to a more renewable sense. So it's a great idea, and I'm glad that I did it. And all the proceeds, my carbon fee, will be going to Citizens Climate Lobby so they can continue to work on getting a real carbon fee enacted in the United States.
Aaron's cousin, Dan Hersher, is a volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby. He helped with the calculations. He reckons Aaron used a little less than 15 tons of carbon based on the racing fuel and tire production. For fuel, he figured 15 cents per gallon. Tires were harder to figure in. He eventually found some EPA data on tire production. Aaron used 58 sets of tires. After adding all the numbers up, Aaron paid $224.09 as a carbon fee. If he were to follow the CCL model, he would then need to raise the fee another $10 to $25 a ton for next season.
Yeah, I would plan on doing it again next season. I like the idea of it being a set system where they know, you know exactly how much it would go up each year to kind of curb your amount of fossil fuel use. Obviously, in racing, it would be difficult for us to be competitive and curb our fossil fuel usage. Obviously, I don't know what we would do. There's no way we can change how many sets of tires we use or how much fuel we burn, really. That's just a set amount. But I am perfectly okay with the amount of carbon fee going up the graduated amount that it should, and I will continue to do it next year as well.
Of course, IndyCar racing could advance to electric racing cars like the Formula E series. With car producers like Tesla, there is new technology, and it's rapidly advancing.
I think it's an incredible new form of racing. And when they have pit stops, they actually just, the driver gets out of a car and goes and gets into a separate car that's already fully charged. You know, we just don't have the technology to know how to charge batteries extremely quickly without there being some sort of a danger if things go wrong. So it's a cool series, and I would like to go and see it. And I know the cars keep on getting faster and faster, a lot faster every year as the technology in batteries and electric motors continues. To be honest, electric energy has a lot more torque than internal combustion engine has, because an internal combustion engine needs to kind of ramp up the power or get it going, get the engine spinning to get things moving. Where an electric engine, you just get the power in and it's immediately there. There's no wait, there's no lag. It's all there, ready to go without any time to waste. So a Tesla accelerates so fast. I'm sure if you've been in one, you press the pedal down, it's immediate. You're just taken off flying. So I really like electric cars, and if I had enough money, I would buy a Tesla right now.
Aaron has accomplished a lot in a little time. He turns 26 in December. I asked him about the future and about climate change. Does he think we will do what it takes to transform our energy economy?
Absolutely. And throughout history, whatever problem that humans have been faced with, we've found solutions to it. So I don't give up hope on, our addiction to carbon at all, because I know that if the right plans are put in place and if people really see the actual danger that can happen, that is happening right now, I have no problem believing that humans will find the solution to it, and we'll all be better off for it.
You can learn a lot more about Aaron at his website, aarontellitz.com. Tellitz is spelled TELITZ. aarontellitz.com. Now it is time for the Art House. Here on Citizens Climate Radio, I feature artists and their art about climate change. You hear about finished pieces of art. The challenge I face is, how do I share the artistic process with you? Many artists begin with a concept, but it is in creating the art that the idea develops and evolves, sometimes radically. Today, I feature an artist in the process of creating new work about climate change. Hope Clark is the director of Wheelbarrow Productions. Based in Kent County, Maryland, USA, Hope is working on a community art project called Make a Movement. Movement is key here, because Hope is a trained dancer who began doing community art far from the USA, in Northern Africa.
It started in Ethiopia, actually, producing a show. What was important to them was economic opportunities. And I met these fabulous artists that needed support. They needed to get paid for what they were doing. So we created an amazing show about Ethiopian history and culture. They were so good at really having everybody's voices heard. And after every rehearsal, everybody could say what they felt and thought, which was astounding to me. The next thing I was able to do was work in Morocco as a resident artist. I realized that I kind of wanted to understand better the mission of Wheelbarrow Productions and what I had created. And I wanted to understand what was important for the community. So I started my project there by just asking everybody, what's important to you? Women really came out and said what was important to them. And it was just beautiful. So I did a project with women, listening to them, doing story circles. And then from those story circles and what was important to them, we created five short scenes, which they performed with a dance in between. And then they stepped off the stage and they led story circles in the audience. For me, that was my goal. I wanted to really press sort of what's the power of art and how does it work for social change. They demanded that only women come to their show. It was Muslim culture, so we had more women's circles. And then they were invited to come back to the Women's Center and continue the work.
After her time of creating art in North Africa, Hope returned to the USA. She then asked herself an important question.
When I come home, what do I do? Well, I'm a citizen, I'm a member of my community, and I decided to do what I thought was important to me. The most important to me was climate change. So as an artist, in a way, some of my approaches have been to allow myself to study. Well, that's part of the process. I get to look at it and take the time. This is what I love about allowing myself to be an artist and really feeling like a community member.
In order to educate people in her community about climate change and to create new art, Hope began to offer workshops to young people and adults. You have to understand that while I interviewed Hope, she didn't just tell me what she worked on. As she spoke, her whole body told the story. As a dancer, she communicates her ideas with words, but also physically.
And I've used this little teaching tool. It's like a mind map of sort of what happens when we have excessive heat trapping gases in our atmosphere. So people can understand why are the oceans getting warmer? We don't have a whole lot of forest anymore. And so all that excessive CO2 is sinking down into our ocean and making it warmer. And then what happens? The ice and snow melts. Evaporation comes out of those oceans. Some areas pulls out the water and creates a drought and wildfires, right? And we're living that right now. So as I'm in the school, they're like, yeah, wildfires in California, yeah. And then, you know, another effect of the evaporation is filling up those clouds with more water and creating stronger storms. And they're like, yeah, you know, that Maria in Puerto Rico, we talk about that. And then, you know, the changing seasons and the migrations of plants and animals and the habitat loss and the extinction. And we're all looking at that in this mind map. And then we do some movement. We actually come back to our bodies. We act out the storms and the weather. The very first thing I did, which was for the climate march, I created some movements that associated with phrases like stir the pot, stop the cook, open the wind, cleanse and wash, let the shift settle, relearn the vision. Let the questions be. Let all the angles in. For me, this was like my attempt to, sort of in an abstract way, open our human being to change.
Then she dug into the artistic project, but she needed a big prop to take on a big issue.
I, of course, just started to talk to everybody about this when I started. The new local management board director, Hope, why don't you use some parachutes? You know, parachutes are a good way to look at sort of movement and weather, actually, and, you know, big CO2 puffs or something like that. And I said to her, do you know about any parachutes around? Because she's, you know, kind of connected with the community. And she's like, my uncle has a humongous one in his shed. And so I was like, okay. And he's like, yeah, we've got this 100-foot parachute in my shed. So I call up my friend. I say, hey, can you come over with me? And we're going to try to pull this out. We pull it out, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's a real parachute. And it's mossy green. And the wind is blowing, and it's looking like storms and wind and deserts and water. And it's just looking gorgeous. The plan is to set that up in the space, which is this big park, Wilmer Park, where lots of people go during a big weekend where there's tons of people here that are here for big boats. I finally came up with the idea to sort of be a circus ringmaster and to use a big megaphone and just call everybody over to the edge of the world. There, I hope that people will come and look at this beautiful parachute, which I've worked with the theater student. They'll be working it. And then ask them to walk around it. And I've decided to put the beautiful posters that the sixth graders have made on kind of yard stands so that the audience can see these amazing, beautiful drawings. And I'll also include a recognition of the Native Americans who have lived here. And I'll also include a really wild, you know, graph that I saw that was just so clear to me in the last four ice ages of how CO2 has gone up and down, which is, you know, one of the arguments that, you know, it's natural. Well, since the last four ice ages, it has been very natural. And CO2 has stayed very under 350 parts per million, which is deemed the safe level. But since 1950, you can see the graph goes straight up. And right now we're at 404. So we are, you know, 50 plus parts per million above what's actually safe. And that's maybe why we're seeing these strong storms and these wildfires and these droughts and these people moving around, trying to get food. The whole other question, right, is what do I do then once I've said all that, right, in an art space? Well, the dancers will dance and the actors will actually play their monologues and show their scenes, which are about how climate change affects them, how they're understanding it. These are our children. To kind of end it, well, I don't really know yet.
Hope has begun to experiment with these ideas. Over the next few months, she will continue to tinker with it and tune it. And I will check in with her in a few months so you can hear how the piece has developed. If you want to see images of the parachute in action and learn more about Hope's work, visit wheelbarrowproductions.org. That's wheelbarrowproductions.org. You can also visit her Make a Movement Facebook page. Find links over at our blog post for this episode at citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. And if you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. The time has come for our monthly puzzler question. Here's last month's question. You're chatting with a neighbor. Let's call her Joan. Joan has family in Florida who were affected by Hurricane Irma. You start talking about climate change and the connections you see to these current weather events. But Joan interrupts you and says, "No, you're wrong. Climate change has nothing to do with these hurricanes. There have always been hurricanes. Scientists make it clear that there is no way you can say climate change has anything to do with these storms." So, is Joan right? How can you effectively and accurately talk about these weather events and climate change? To answer the question is Glenn Retiff from Sunbury, Pennsylvania. Glenn teaches creative writing at Susquehanna University.
I think of it as being like gambling or like doping in sports. If you have loaded dice, you can't say that the given double sixes that you threw, you can't say that that's caused by the loading of the dice, but you can say that the loading of the dice makes a double six much more likely. Similarly with doping in sport, you can't say that it was the dopes that caused Ben Johnson to win the 100 meters in the Olympics, but you can say that that made it more likely and that it wasn't fair. So what we're doing right now, we're doping up our climate and causing all kinds of weird effects.
Thank you, Glenn. So, are you ready for this month's puzzler? Well, it's not really a puzzler. It's a question about the puzzlers. Should we continue to have a monthly puzzler question? Is it helpful to you? If so, do you have any suggestions for puzzler questions? If not, well, then that opens up more space for either another section to add, or I can lengthen the main section or the Art House section. Let me know what you think. Send me your answers. Get back to me by December 20th, 2017. You can email me your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. Thanks for joining me on this episode of Citizens Climate Radio. In our next show, we will consider the emotional and psychological effects of climate change. Feel free to send me any ideas you have for the episode. I'll give contact information in a moment. This show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All of the music we use on the show is licensed, unless otherwise specified. Special music for the Art House segment includes One Suite from the free 1920s collection on archive.org. Please feel free to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Just look for Citizens Climate Lobby wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/citizensclimateradio. You can follow us on Twitter as well, @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.